Accession number 19382, Reel 3.
Yes, the Japanese we met were really quite pleasant, especially, I mean, the main people employed were fairly young Japanese women, and they seemed very pleasant. There weren't many men there, Japanese men, but the women were fine. Of course, I mean, in terms of employment, I don't really think there were many employment opportunities, and I think the occupation forces provided a substantial field of employment, and also, one would guess, a certain access to food supplies and things like that, which were absolutely critical in Japan at the time.
Well, did people give them presents?
Well, I did, I must say. One of the jobs that we had to do, which was nothing to do with receiving messages, was to actually go out and guard the transmitter, which was situated a few miles out of town. And so we had to go out and do that. And we were actually provided with a rifle and some ammunition to do that. There was a small party of us out there. I mean, the danger of attack by the Japanese, I think, was absolutely negligible. But you could see that it was sensible to be cautious about the situation. And so we guarded this transmitter, and we came in contact with the Japanese there. I mean, I think the Japanese deliberately fostered these contacts, in a sense. I mean, they had to. Yes, I think the Japanese were... Well, I mean, the Japanese did what they had to do at the time, and they were very anxious to get food and so on and so forth, and if they could, they'd want to do that. And I entirely understand that, and I think really all sorts of things they did at the time were entirely understandable in the context of the difficult situation they were in.
Why did you say you could see it was wise to have these guards if there was no danger of...
Well, I think it was probably just typical caution, but also, and I think understandable caution too. I mean, I think, it seemed to me at the time, it seemed almost inconceivable that the Japanese, who were nothing if not powerful adversaries, and you know, would almost never give up, really, in military terms, it seemed almost inconceivable that within a few months they would just accept the situation and just allow themselves to be occupied without any protest. This was difficult to believe that they would operate in that they would accept it in those terms, and I think people felt slightly uneasy. And then on top of that, I mean, it was a terribly difficult time for them, with no employment, I suppose, and the place completely ruined and devastated, and shortage of food. I mean, you know, that was the sort of situation where any common sense interpretation, I mean, you might expect trouble, really. And I certainly thought that might occur.
But there was none?
It didn't happen, no. I suppose one always hears these stereotypes about the Japanese being so disciplined and so on and so forth, and when they're told to stop, they just do stop, and the emperor's told them to give up, and so you have to give up. But that really did seem to be the case, yes. Yes, they didn't... I mean, I think in a sense, their attitude was they were sort of struck dumb by the situation, really. I think until the very last moment, until the atomic bombs had dropped, I don't think the idea of being defeated had really been brought home to them at all. And I think they fully expected to fight across the whole length and breadth of Japan, which indeed would have been a dreadful experience for all concerned. And I say all concerned, I mean both the people who were attempting to do it and the Japanese population themselves. But I'm pretty sure if they'd been told to do it, they jolly well would have done it. But fortunately, they were struck by this situation, I think, and told to give up, and did.
Any hostility or coolness or tensions with the Japanese?
Well, as I say, we didn't meet many of the Japanese men. I think one might have expected rather more hostility there. But the ones I came across, no. Of course, it was difficult to establish contact with the Japanese, for at least a number of reasons, really. I mean, first of all, there was the obvious language problem. Although that was overcome to a degree. I mean, some Japanese had a few words of English, and you know, there's the usual sign language and so on and so forth. But that was one aspect. The other aspect was, of course, that you tended to be rather self-contained and live in your own barracks or depot, whatever it was, and not have too much contact with them. Although, as I say, in fact, there were quite a lot of Japanese working in the base. So that was a difficulty, and then you weren't actually supposed to fraternise with the Japanese either. And although I did establish some contact, and in fact go out to a Japanese home on one occasion, and was treated very, very courteously indeed, and drunk sake and so on, but in general I think most people didn't have any contact, or very, very little contact indeed with them, with the Japanese.
So you ignored the no fraternisation order?
Well, I don't think one was in any very great danger of being caught or anything like that. You didn't make do too much shouting about it. The main way, of course, that people did fraternise, if that's the right expression, I'm not sure that it is really, is that, and one has to say this, I mean, because it applies probably around naval bases or services depots, generally, is that the Japanese women used to be quite a lot of prostitution, and people used to catch venereal disease to quite a large extent. Not me, I'm glad to say, but others did, and I think it was not only an experience to be avoided from the point of view of the medical remedies at the time, but also because it was a disciplinary offence as well.
Do you think that was the main reason for the so-called non-fraternisation order?
Yes, it might have been. I doubt that myself. I think that the non-fraternisation order was more a reflection of the feeling against the Japanese on the part of at least some people at the time, and certainly a feeling against the Japanese on the part of the people who would have given the orders. I mean, the feeling of hatred towards the Japanese.
Did you or your shipmates feel hatred towards Japanese people?
I'm not sure that I could speak for my shipmates. I think most of them were fairly neutral about the whole thing, really. I do remember one occasion of one person rather ill-treating a Japanese young man, but that was frowned on by people. As far as I was concerned, I mean, I'd assimilated quite a lot of the anti-Japanese propaganda, and I suppose probably agreed with it. But once you get to Japan and you see the utterly depressing, drab starvation, people doing things that they really don't want to do, but they do because they have no alternative, like the prostitution and so on. I mean, it's utterly, I think, probably alien to Japanese character. And it's really, I mean, one, you know, I felt rather a noble thing to do almost. You can't sustain these sort of feelings. Not if you're there for some months and you come in contact and see them day after day around you and in contact with you, and they're quite pleasant people and they're smiling and helpful and they're cooking your food and they're doing your washing. I mean, how on earth can you maintain a feeling of hatred towards people in that sort of situation? At least that's the way I felt about it, and I don't think one can really sustain that sort of feeling in that atmosphere.
So what happened in the case of that unpleasant incident?
Well, I think somebody was... I can't remember how the problem arose, but... some antagonism. I think it was somebody on the British side saying, wanting to get the Japanese to accept that they'd completely lost the war, you know, and to try and throw their weight around in that really rather silly sort of way. And the Japanese were, well, I mean, I don't suppose they would have disagreed with the conclusion, but they weren't going to be humiliated either. And you know, a certain amount of fighting occurred, but it was only an isolated incident. And I mean, when I say isolated, I'm not just glossing over things. I genuinely mean I just one isolated thing.
You mean it was a fist fight?
Well, I think they were sort of wrestling and twisting arms and that sort of thing.
What was the outcome?
Oh, the outcome, I think, really was that the man on the British side was told to stop doing it, really, by other people, by other British. I mean, saying, you know, this is really taking things too far, and you mustn't. But then, of course, you always get idiots like that about in any situation. But I suppose perhaps he was more typical than I like to think. I mean, perhaps I'm being too idealistic about it. Perhaps, you know, there was this feeling that, you know, we wanted to make the Japanese realise that we were the masters or something of that sort. But I don't really think it was a general feeling. But it might have been more general than I care to. Than I care to accept.
Did you travel about?
Not very much. We went to around a little bit. I mean, there were some quite delightful areas within the Japanese inland sea, a place called Maijima, which is a shrine, and you go up a steep a mountain. And we were fortunate in a way. We were reasonably well looked after in terms of entertainment, in terms of films and that sort of thing. But also, we were given access to a Japanese small boat ship, which went out every week, I think it was, around the Japanese islands of the inland sea, which I said earlier were a delightful area. I think they're not so now. I think they're covered with shipyards and things like that, but in those days they were quite extraordinarily beautiful, and we used to go swimming from the boat or from the islands, and also visit the shrines and generally look around and see what the Japanese were doing. I mean, they were marvellous at using the most tiny areas to grow food, and of course they had to because they were so short of food, and growing rice and so on and so forth on these small mountainous islands. And we went around the islands. We went from a place called Hiro, which was fairly near, and also to Hiroshima itself, of course, which was about 10 kilometres away. But by the time we got to Hiroshima, the Japanese had done a tremendous job of clearing the place up. And although it was devastation, as far as the eye could see, practically, the ruins had been mainly cleared up and taken away.
When you say devastation, you mean just empty?
Yes, just empty. Yes, that's right. Mm. The roads were there. The roads had been cleared, but there were no... Well, there were a few of the more substantial buildings, but most of the buildings had been completely obliterated.
And Nagasaki, did you go there?
No, I didn't go to Nagasaki, no. I'm not sure how serious the... devastation. I believe it wasn't quite so serious in Nagasaki, but Hiroshima was certainly you couldn't really form any conception of what had happened in a way. I mean, I suppose you could compare it with London, and in that sense, it was very much, of course, very much more widespread than the devastation in London.
Did you pick up Japanese language?
No, apart from the usual sayonara and things like that, which everybody knows. Not really. The Japanese were, as I said earlier, I mean, managed to communicate a little bit at any rate. But, I mean, to say one could form any general impression of Japanese attitudes, well, I think you could, actually. As I say, I think from their general bearing and approach... You could, but in terms of actual conversation with them, I think that was out, really.
Was it a happy or unhappy time for you in Corée?
Well, I would say on the whole, I would say we were very anxious to get home, actually. Yes. It got to be very, very monotonous after a time. I think that after a time, you were just doing the same thing over and over again. And people even got to the stage where, although people have been quite keen, for example, to go out on this boat around the islands, after a few months, people got fed up with it and intended not to go. You tended, I mean, the place was so utterly depressing, and the buildings were destroyed and so on all round about. And there were no British female company either, which might have improved matters, but there wasn't any, virtually none of that. And you just got really, I suppose, rather depressed, I think, honestly. So I think people were very anxious. Certainly I was very anxious to get home.
How did you get home?
Well, ultimately on a troop ship. I can't remember the name of it, but that arrived, and it was extremely cramped, of course, as troop ships always are, and brought home British and naval personnel and army as well. And I don't know if they were running the actual occupation forces down a bit. They may well have been, but obviously it was quite expensive, I suppose, to maintain occupation forces. Although, in fact, I think the Japanese were forced to pay for quite a few of the facilities themselves. So we came home. I can't remember, it was towards the end of 46, I think, September of 46, something like that. I mean, I was very glad to have been in Japan. I thought it was a very interesting experience, and I formed a surviving opinion of the Japanese and their determination. I'd like to think that the British would have operated in the same way, and I think they probably would. I mean, in the Blitz, it was quite a lot of very good feeling, and I think that would suggest that the British would have done the same. But the devastation in Japan was very much more serious, and the general social conditions were absolutely appalling. And yet they managed to deal with these, I think, in a way which I think was really rather praiseworthy.
We sometimes hear about discontent of the mob.
Mm.
Did you come across that?
No, not really. I mean, I'd only been in the forces about 3 years, and it wasn't. I hadn't served a long time, and I was quite young. And obviously, the people who'd served longer had been demobilised earlier on, and that seemed only right. So, in fact, I mean, the demob arrangement seemed generally pretty fair, and I don't think anybody had any particular criticism of them. The only thing I do recall is that when we got back to base in Britain, we were stationed in a depot, I suppose, for a few weeks, anyway, while they sorted things out. And I remember one of the non-commissioned officers coming along and saying, "Well, you're all wanting to get out of the Navy now, I'm sure." And we said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "But you'll all be needed back in again fairly soon," or something like that. I don't quite know what disaster he was anticipating, anyway, we left with a glad heart, and I had my former job to go back to, so that was no particular problem. And we had a bit of leave after that, and I remember we came back from Portsmouth, and of course you come into Waterloo always vowing that you're going to meet other people again and so on and so forth, but you've got your life to get on with, really, and you tend not to do that, or at least in my case I tended not to.
Do you feel you've learned anything from having experienced the Second World War and a period in the Royal Navy?
Oh, yes, I certainly think so. I think my life would have been very much poorer had it not been for that. I mean, I think people who go on from a school or even university and go into straight into a job, miss an enormous amount of a rich experience, which is absolutely impossible to to duplicate. Of course, one doesn't want to have another war to duplicate it, but you meet all sorts and types of people, and you see all sorts of places which I would never have dreamt I would have seen. I suppose one nowadays one can go almost anywhere, but at that time you couldn't. And being at sea was, I thought, a wonderful experience as well. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I would never have the opportunity to do that. And also, to be on a warship is an experience that is difficult to describe, really. But the companionship and so on is a very interesting and fascinating experience, really, which I just don't think you can reproduce in any other way. And you're in the forces, of course. You know you've got to be in the forces, and you adapt, of course, to the situation. You know you've got to obey orders, and on the other hand, you can bend the corners a little bit if you have the opportunity to do so. And also, as I say, I felt it was rewarding, because certainly at the time I thought it was a thoroughly necessary and essential job to defeat Germany and Japan too. So I thought it was a very, very rewarding experience.